Hi there. This is week two of Scott Caparo's podcast. I'd like to call it Stand Up, Sit Down, but apparently there's a copyright issue. So we're searching for a title. In the meantime, week two of the podcast where I like to bring on artists, that includes stand-up comics, writers, politicians, anyone who speaks out loud in public and shows their wares to a public audience, who'd like to then come in and talk about what inspires them to do what they do. I always think it's interesting, I mentioned last week, to find out the origins of a joke or a chapter or a story or an idea. I think it makes whatever concept that person's trying to put across a bit clearer. And in stand-up comedy, I think it makes it even funnier, potentially. So that's what we're here to talk about today with Leo Kirse, the brilliant stand-up comic. We're going to discuss his inspiration and why he's in trouble. Leo Kirse, right-wing comedian and Scottish Comedian of the Year, whom Chortle, the UK comedy website, calls a giant in the art of comedy, and whose new show, Transgressive, is about Leo being banned from hotels, Facebook parties, and a fringe venue due to accusations of transphobia. Even though he wrote jokes with a trans woman he was dating, and he's with us today at the glorious Top Secret Comedy Club on Drury Lane in glamorous London. Leo Kirse, thank you. Welcome for coming. Thanks for coming. Welcome.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
You're welcome. Look, I like to have people on who are kicking shit up a little bit, but also I always think, I mentioned this last week, it's so interesting. I think you're a great comic, and it's great to learn stuff about a comedian. Oftentimes it makes the comedy funnier. Do you think that's true, if you know a little bit more about
them? Yeah, and I think if you've got some sort of personal investment in the comedian, and a lot of comedy is sort of personality driven, if you know what I mean. Like, if you look at Chris Rock or Bill Burr, I'm loving, like, Bill Burr, it's like, you know, it's like the crazy guy at the end of the bar who's just like, you know, shooting his mouth off about stuff. So when you buy into that character, it's like, you know, his character and personality that drives a lot of the comedy.
Well, I'm surprised at what I read about this online, because I follow you on Facebook, but I also read some other stuff about you having been banned from this club, and you can talk more about that in a second. But I just thought it was so strange, because for one thing, if you go to a comedy club, you should expect to have your beliefs or feelings shaken up a bit, because it's live performance. And I prefer a show where I don't know what's going to happen next. That's how I am. But also, when you wrote these jokes about, you know, trans people, I just thought, why would someone take offense at that? Because these are jokes about your personal life. So what they should be doing is saying, thank you for letting us in a bit, because now we know more about you and we can enjoy the jokes even more.
Yeah.
But tell me what happened. Explain to the audience why. Because you work all over the UK, all over the world. You tour everywhere.
Yeah. And this was in Australia. So,
just tell us why you label yourself a right-wing comedian, though. What's that about?
I did it basically because I don't like how there's this cloying, sort of all-encompassing attitude in comedy that everybody's got to be left-wing, everybody's got to be a socialist, and you can't criticize those anything with those. And I'm a sort of socially liberal and economically conservative.
You're cheap, is what you mean. Yeah. You don't tip.
I believe you can do what you want, but I'm not paying for it. That's basically how I feel. And I think that's, you know, how a lot of people feel, but they don't feel that they can voice it. Everybody's, you know, especially in comedy, everybody's like, you know, so left-wing. I mean, at least they pretend they're left-wing. All comedians are actually totally right-wing. They're self-starting entrepreneurs going out and hustling for work. And the pay structure on comedy nights is really unequal. Like, the headliner will get, you know, £300 or whatever, and the middle spot will get, you know, £20. I've never seen one of these virtuous left-wing headliners demanding that their pay is equally distributed amongst all
the workers. Okay, now wait a minute. They give you a £5 tip allotment here at this club that we're in right now. And last night I gave it to the bar. So, you know, I gave my £5 to the fuck off. Anyway, yes. But no, I know what you mean. There's a disparity between salaries.
Yeah.
And I'm always surprised that the compere doesn't make a huge amount, because they're there all night long.
Oh, yeah. And they do the most work. Like, being a compere isn't fun. Yeah. You know, you've got to go up. You've got to warm up the totally cold crowd. Yeah. You've got to tell them what's happening.
And
you've got to deal with any issues.
Again.
Yeah, doing a set is great. You just go up, do 25 minutes. Just like, it's on rails. You know what you're doing. Then you get out there, do another one, get more money.
Exactly. Yeah, it's tough for them. But anyway, so also, do you think being Scottish in any way affects people's response to you calling yourself right-wing? Because at least from my perspective, I don't know, maybe this is because I'm foreign, I think everyone thinks Scottish people are mostly liberal, especially the SNP and the reaction to what's happening in Brexit right now.
Yeah, yeah, Scottish people are, there's a real socialist tradition in Scotland because of all the, you know, heavy industry and also the sort of hatred of the English and the hatred of being ruled by the Tories and the Tories closing the coal mines and stuff, which is stuff I talk about in my show.
But for you to say you're right-wing, people might think, is he a Scottish Tory? And then you're like an alien to them.
Oh, people in Scotland assumed I was joking and it was some sort of parody. And, you know, then when I'm coming out with my stuff, just, you know, explaining, because in my comedy show, I Can Make You Tory, explained, you know, how centrally controlled socialist economies don't work. And, like, you know, the free market is the best way to run most things, which is just, it just makes sense, you know. And people didn't understand it. And, like, closing down the coal mines is actually a good thing. People are like, oh, destroyed communities and stuff. It's like, man, do you want to work in a coal mine? You really want to work in a coal mine instead of, like, sitting in an office pissing about on Facebook? I'd way rather work above ground, like in the sunshine.
Your life expectancy on a coal mine is like 45 and stuff. And you,
which is long for Scotland.
But so when you went to Australia, and you can tell us the story about being banned, but was the name of your show something about being right-wing?
Yeah, so my show was Right Wing Comedian. That's the title of the show last year. So I was doing it in Perth. I did it in Perth and Adelaide. And
for people that
Tasmania.
Don't know, describe Perth. Because this show airs in places where people might not know anything about Perth.
All right, so Perth in Australia is quite an isolated. It's about a sort of 4-hour flight from the nearest. I think it's the most isolated big city in the world.
All right.
It's like a 4 or 5 hour flight from Adelaide, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a long way. It's a mining town. So lots of money from mining, lots of sort of people getting really rich, you know, quite a sort of right-wing, young, industrious, entrepreneurial place, and people getting rich that aren't, you know, lawyers or whatever. They're just men and women who work with their hands or, you know, work in mining.
But you go to Australia frequently?
Yeah, so the last couple of years I've gone over there because I can't stand the winter in the UK.
And what's your perception of politics in Australia? I mean, in general, is it sort of a little left leaning or a little right leaning, or what I'm asking is, do you feel more comfortable calling yourself right wing in a country like Australia?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Australia people are much less ashamed to come out and admit to being right wing and voting for, you know, sensible economic policies. Over here, it's, you know, if you put on Facebook that you're voting for the Tories. Even though they get in, so somebody's voting for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you want to be in a winning team for a change. You put that on Facebook and people... I mean, do you think that being a right-wing comedian sets you apart and gives you sort of a hook or a handle? That
100%. Yeah, I mean, the BBC have told me that it means they can book me because, I mean, I'm a white man in his 40s. You
so
know,
back
what I mean?
Back of the line for you.
Yeah, back of the line.
Nothing racist about that, by the way. Get the back of the line, though. Back of the bus.
Which I understand, you know, all comedians are like white men in their 40s, you know, so I understand you want some diversity and stuff.
Yeah.
But it does mean I've got to do something to stand out. So, you know, whether that's dating a transgender woman or being right wing, you know, I'm probably going to convert to Islam next. Yeah. But you've got to do something.
So where did you meet your transgender person?
Online.
Is that and I know that this is an un-PC question, but that is a transition from male to female?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
A full transition. My husband asked me that.
It's an ongoing process. Thing. So she's, she's still, I'm still friends with her. She's still, you know, going through. I think her next thing she's getting done is the jawbone shaving.
Oh, good Lord. And that sounds painful to me. And that, is she British?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well. So you went to Australia with her?
No, that was, I dated her like 5 years ago and then her again last year, funnily enough, we met up.
To see how the changes had.
Yeah.
Did you get that stuff I asked you to get?
I like these new tits.
all right. So, did she go to Perth with you then?
No.
And so you wrote some material with her before you left for Perth? Subject?
Last year, about this time last year, we wrote some material. Because I noticed Chappelle and Gervais, they were doing material about transgender people, but it was quite sort of mean-minded. And, you know, I just felt that, I mean, obviously I don't begrudge them doing that stuff, but, you know, transgender people, it's the last section of society that is sort of openly discriminated against and sort of hated on. So I just wanted to do something that was like slightly, you know, it's about transgender people, but not having a go at them, not making them the butt of the joke.
Well, let's hear the clip. I have it here, and we're going to bring it up now.
The male privilege as well, that's You know, apparently I've got a lot of male privilege. I reckon it's hard being a man. That's why so many of us are transitioning. So many. And you've got to remember, it's a lot harder for a man to transition than it is for a woman. If a woman wants to transition to being a man, she just takes hormones, grows a beard, and everybody goes, look, that man's got tits. You know what I mean? Transition, I've got to take the hormones, I've got to have surgery, I've got to like get a new wardrobe, I've got to find high heels that are size 15, I've got to like remove all my body hair, I've got to like learn to walk in these heels, I've got to learn to talk in a high-pitched voice, and after the end of all that effort and expense, people just point at me and go, look, that man's got tits. There's inequality between men and women. Like, yeah, there is like 97% of workplace related deaths are male. 97%, that means for every 33 men who like fall off an oil rig or get dragged into a winch and ripped apart or like do something else that's fucking hard. I should really finish writing that joke. 33 men who do that, like just one woman gets lost inside a duty cover and can't find her way out. Everyone's still on board? Not complaining about the tampon tax, like apparently it's like 40p on a packet of tampons or whatever, which is terrible, but try paying for dinner.
Now, that clip is from a bit of set that you said. Is that the part that you were banned from performing? Were you banned from performing that show or banned from doing your entire show because of that clip?
I was banned from a venue in Perth. So the venue is an LGBTQ venue. And obviously some patrons saw that there's a show there called Right Wing Comedian.
Right.
And, obviously, historically, the right wing hasn't been very nice to the LGBTQ community. I mean,
Cameron legalized gay marriage.
Yeah, so it's changing now. You know, the right wing is like a lot more progressive.
Believe me, left-leaning people, I know what you mean, definitely. And left-leaning people, though, even Obama, were never great friends. You know, queers hate Clinton for a lot of reasons. But anyway.
Right.
Go on. But you're right. I understand how the perceptions might be.
So I understand, you know, and obviously they saw that this show Right Wing Comedian was on in this venue, mm-hmm. and they dug back through my Twitter feed, and you know when they go back to like 2004 and like pull something out.
Jesus.
They went back to that afternoon, and they tweeted this clip that you just played, and
that clip's funny.
Well, I think it's funny, and also it's not. I'm not saying. I mean, it's about. I mean, that's an early version of the joke. Now it's like it's more it's punchier and stuff. But it's about the difference in the different beauty standards between men and women, and much harder it is for a man to transition than it is for a woman.
Right.
So it's a genuine thing.
I mean Caitlyn Jenner. There's elements of that that's a disaster, actually.
Yeah.
You know,
and Caitlyn Jenner's got infinite money to spend on it.
Exactly.
Imagine if you've only got like 100 quid. You know what I mean? Like, what are you gonna do?
I've seen those people at shows in San Francisco. You know, San Francisco has a long history of transitioning people, and you're right. Some of them can look a bit rough.
Yeah. And Danny, Danny's like really glamorous and sort of.
This is your ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, and like beautiful. She does like modeling and stuff. And you know she she just thinks it's hilarious when you get these guys that like chuck on a frock and go up to the bar like, can I have a glass of Chardonnay please? You know what I mean? It's like,
well, you know, there's all sorts of levels of it, aren't there?
Yeah,
I mean,
and
for some people it's dressing up, for some people it's more extreme, but I can't imagine them seeing that clip and then telling you can't play the venue because of that clip.
Yeah, well, I think there was assumptions. But obviously, I look like, I'm just like some straight white guy who's like, doing stuff about transgender people and, punching down and stuff. So if they don't know the context,
punching down is them being self-hating. It's not you hating them.
You're
benching them your act because you think it's an important issue. Them thinking that you can't make fun of them is them not respecting themselves, as far as I'm concerned, isn't it?
Yeah, and also, I mean, there were very few. I think there's only one transgender person that complained. The rest were people who identify as queer, which I think is a cop-out. You know what I mean? Like, they're just doing it.
What do you mean identify as queer? What does that mean?
So, you know, you get these people are like straight, but they're like, oh, I identify as queer, you know, like, but it's just like, they're trying to look cool. It's like in the 90s, people liked obscure indie bands to try and look cool. Now, the cool thing is like, you know, being a bit, you know, sexually ambiguous or whatever, you know.
Because they're boring and they try to look a bit more interesting.
It's trying to add an aspect to their personality or whatever. And the other people that complained were drag acts who are like, I mean, that's like trans.
Drag acts performed and complained?
Drag acts complain and they're like trans blackface. That is... That is like a minstrel complaining about racism.
You know, you're right. With trans acts, you have to be. I mean, with trannies on stage, you have to be really careful. Oh yeah. My god, because they can fierce. Be really racist, horribly racist. Yeah. I used to host talent contests and shows on gay vacations in the States, and I stopped. One of the reasons was because I couldn't be on stage with these people. They would literally black up and put a dress on and think it was okay, and the audience would laugh at it. It was horrifying. But so when you did this venue in Perth. Tell you couldn't perform there when you arrived?
No, it was before then. They just instantly, as soon as people complained, they just instantly pulled the show, which I can understand, and I wasn't going to put up a fuss because it's an LGBT...
People complain about other comics all the time.
Yeah, but it's an LGBTQ venue, so I didn't want to, you know, make a fuss and be like, no, you've got to, you know, let me come into your safe space.
Yeah. Although they'd already booked you and hired you, they could have researched you on their own. And,
well, they booked the promoter, put my show on, so, right. I mean, maybe, like, thinking about it, like, we should have put the show in a different venue. But yeah, there's a funny bit that they said, this is an inclusive space, so...
Right, except.
You have to leave.
But did you try to defend yourself and say, look, I wrote these jokes with an LGBTQ person who I used to date and all that, and nothing?
I gave an interview with an LGBTQ magazine where I said, you know, look, I didn't mean to cause offense or not that kind of offense.
Right.
You know?
Like, right,
I wrote this material on with a transgender woman I was dating, which puts me on that. It puts me on that LGBTQIAP
spectrum a little bit.
The only way you can get on there is by fucking your way on.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
surely
that's how we all got there.
They've made that acronym too inclusive now. It's got me in it.
And there's a plus at the end, so any garbage you got, just throw it in. What else you got? We'll take anything. You know, yes. I have to tell you that I myself would have a hard time playing an LGBTQ venue. It's on an audience that I cater to in my act. Even though I began as a stand-up comic and an actor in LGBTQ venues, a particular one in San Francisco, that one was run by someone with a vision who had a very open mind about what he liked on stage, and he was a fan of mine. But I got in trouble then, and the worst response I've ever gotten to my work until Birmingham 3 weeks ago was mostly, almost always, LGBTQ people. And I cannot... play this one. I can't do Bent Double in Brighton. I can't do So He's Gay, because I did it once and the lesbians literally tried to kill me. I had to be escorted out.
No way.
Well, I think that you're right. I think sometimes when you start labeling a community or doing or self-identifying with a certain political stance, and that stance glues your feet to the ground, there's just no way that when you say everything's inclusive, the minute you say it, it's untrue, I think.
Yeah.
It's like saying you're in love with somebody and then you have to feel it all the time.
Yeah,
it's a risk. Anyway, so but you went to Australia anyway.
Yeah. So I sorted out another venue. So I just, you know, instead of the promoter fronting the money, I just paid. I produced my own show. Paid.
So
for
did
my
he
own
let
venue.
You go as well? Did he say, look, I've got to let you go? Also, the promoter just wouldn't.
No, the promoter did loads of work from out there, so it was fine.
But you had to find your own venue after that.
So I found my own venue for my solo show. I was still doing, you know, spots for this other promoter. But so I found my own venue, and the show was a success. And,
oh, good.
So I made money, and it was
great.
Good.
Good, because it can be difficult. I hear in Australia, some comics tell me they lose money when they go.
I think some of the, like Adelaide, I made money doing the spots, but I didn't make much money on my solo show. I mean, I still made some money. Actually, I probably made more money off my solo show than I'd make over here doing clubs in February. So.
Oh, right. Is that because there's such stiff competition now at the festivals in Australia? Everybody goes there and everybody's
competing. Yeah, I think so. And Adelaide's quite a small city. It's like the size of Edinburgh, but it doesn't get that influx of tourists that you know, means you've got like big populations going to the shows in Edinburgh. So you're really just performing to the locals. And there's so many shows on that it's just thinned out.
So there's something else about Australia must inspire you, not just the weather. I mean, do you go there hoping that you can just... see a bunch of stuff happening, they'll get you to write new material, or you're in front of fresh audiences that know anything about you, or I mean, do you like the anonymity of that? Do you prefer performing in front of people that know nothing about you? Do you like that?
I think I prefer, my favorite shows are when I do a solo show and it's people coming knowing what the show is about and wanting to see the show. I think some of my stuff, when you just dump it in front of fresh faces who aren't really sure what it's going to be, it doesn't always go so well because it's quite hard, you know, quite harsh comedy. And
but what, so when you're looking at a joke on paper, why do you include it in your act or not include it?
If it makes me laugh.
Because I asked you for some clips that we could discuss. And fondly enough, which I think is a great quality of yours, and I think very Scottish, you sent me clips of other people's work. Because you're not self-centered about it. You're thinking, why would, you know. And that was great. We won't use those, but a couple of them were so dry.
Yeah.
And so one of the clips you sent me was a comic commenting on other comics and how shit they were. Relentlessly, again.
Yeah,
again,
really trolling the entire comedy community.
Over a span of time.
Yeah, over years.
He's addicted. Do you think it's okay to make fun of the lack of quality of other comedians? I think it's okay to mention other comics if you admire them.
Yeah.
But I'm not brave enough to pick on other comics when I'm on stage because I'm afraid what to say about me. Do you find it funny to other comics?
I think it's, yeah. And I'm in a sort of Facebook group that's just dedicated to this one comedian who we think is terrible, but he's so bad. It's like an Alan Partridge thing. Uh-huh. And we all go to see his show every year. And,
at the Fringe in Edinburgh?
Yeah, and it's not so. I'm in one Facebook group. There's other WhatsApp groups. Like, I went to see his show.
About this one comic?
There's Perry Award winners, like, in the audience. Like, just there to see it because he's so bad. He'd sold out. My mate couldn't get in. It was amazing. But the audience was all comedians there to see it. Cause it's,
but
like,
how
so
bad is it,
and
do you
it's,
think?
It's, oh, it's
what's the subject matter? What is
catastrophic.
Is it a man
so
or
it's a
or
lot.
A
it's a man, and a lot of it's quite woke comedy about anxiety and overthinking stuff. And,
is he British?
Like, he's British, yeah. Yeah, and he's one of these people who's tried to... he's not very good at comedy, so he's trying to administrate his way to the top of comedy by running forums and all the rest of it.
Is it working?
No, because he's really bad at comedy.
And he'll never learn it.
It's just some people got funny bones, and some people have just got bones that are the opposite of funny.
But what do you extract from that, though? Is he so desperate just to be liked by the audience that he'll just keep trying and trying and trying?
Yeah, he tries. And also, it's got this amazing... You know when you watch The Office or Alan Partridge, and it's just got that, like, amazing sort of unctuous just twist of awkwardness that, like, you know, really gets you. It's just like that. I can feel my testicles rotating while I watch it, you know
but,
what I mean?
But you enjoy.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible. It's like an orgasm. Like, it's just amazing.
And then after the show, when you leave, like an orgasm, do you feel like, oh, God, I've got to lay down now. I've got to take a nap.
Well, then we go to the pub and discuss, you know. It's like,
and he doesn't know. He must know some of this is going on. But it's online, so he can find some of it.
Yeah, and he used to do all these vlogs. And
But he thinks you're there in the audience because you like him.
Yeah, I mean, we do like him.
Because
he's awful. I've got a pillow at my house that's got his face on it.
Oh,
it's,
Jesus.
I'm obsessed. Other comedians arranged a pub quiz. This wasn't even in, like, my group. There's so many groups of people. In my group, there's, like, people in Japan and stuff who fly to Edinburgh. I mean, obviously not just to see the show, but they fly from Japan to Edinburgh to see shows, and this is one of the shows they see.
Does he
and
comment on Japanese people in his audience? Like, well, how did you get here?
No, we just, like, you know, it's friends of friends. We share these videos, and people are like, this is amazing.
Does he talk to the audience at all? Or does he
and it's the worst audience interaction I've ever seen. He asks them questions, and then so he'll ask them a question, and they'll be like, oh, that's really thrown me. Now I need to go back and think about what I was doing. It's like, you asked them the question. You haven't, like, heckled. You asked them the question. You know,
he's thrown by his own question. Yeah. So, and he doesn't have an answer for it. Because one trick a comic told me years ago is you should always have an answer to every question you ask an audience member so you don't get thrown. But he hasn't heard that trick.
No.
So when you're watching him, does he teach you at all how to be a better comic? Do you watch him and think, I would never, that's one thing I'll never do? Do you think that's part of it for you?
Maybe. I mean, it definitely makes you feel more confident in your own abilities.
Right.
Watching.
It's like dating an ugly person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Feel better
in bed. Pressure's off.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Like,
you can
and they have to be good at what they do because they're so fucking ugly. So you're thinking, you know, I'm not that. I'm not that shit.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, I was playing Sheffield once once. And this is why. I did the first night there, and the club manager said, you know, just get out there. Just he's a local favorite. He's, you know, big fish. And he said, they're shit. Just do your set and get off. I'm like, nice to meet you. And then I did my set, and they were garbage. But, you know, they were garbage for everybody. And then he had his assistant call me in my hotel room, like a three-night gig, to fire me. We're going to pay you for the three nights, but we're going to fire you because, and I, why? I don't know. I said, get him on the phone. He's with his family. Get him on. I don't want to talk to his assistant. So I get the guy on the phone. He said, you're the worst comedian I've ever seen, ever, in all of comedy. And I've seen a lot. I'm like, you didn't watch my set. No, you're right. He said, I left the room. But we've got some notes because people fill out notes on the, he's one of those people. You can fill
out
notes.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And someone said, you were terrible. I said, but, and you know, we, and then he friended me on Facebook. It was so surreal. Anyway, but I had for like 3 days, I thought I'm the worst.
Yeah,
I'm the worst. And then I watched some stuff online that was such garbage. And I remember thinking, what you just said is reminding me that I'm not this bad. And that sometimes you need that to get back on stage because we are only as good as our last gig. It's that weird thing, isn't it? People think that what we choose is this profession like law or medicine. And no matter how, you know, I mean, a doctor might kill somebody or a lawyer might lose a case, but they're still experienced at what they do.
And they've got the credentials and they can go out and get another job with that weight of experience. And they know how everything works. It's a process rather than an art.
Right.
I mean, with comedy, it can all crumble at any moment. If you stop being funny, that's it. You don't get booked again.
It's weird, isn't it? I mean, people think, oh, you know, you go on at this club and you seem confident and all that stuff. But if you don't get laughs at a certain level, at a club like this one where in central London, they may never, and they may be in the office just not listening to your efforts, just listening to the amount of laughter you get.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's 100 comedians ready to fill your
thousands.
Boots. Yeah, yeah.
And there's a stack, you're right. And so, and does he play clubs in London?
No, he doesn't really. He doesn't. I spoke to him at a gig the last.
Are you friends with him?
No, no, he doesn't. He doesn't like me for some reason. I don't know why.
Well, but, I figured it out myself. I guess
he told me. He told me he'd stopped doing clubs to focus on his tours.
Tours.
So yeah, and that's, tours? I mean, that's like me. I boycotted Fabergé eggs to focus on buying cheap shit. You know, focus on.
I'm blushing. So he doesn't tour because he wants to mix his act better, but it doesn't work. Like touring might help actually.
Well, he tours his own show, so he goes, he arranges, he phones up like little cafes and you know places like that. And
how does that go for him? Do you think?
Well, I've seen some of the videos and it doesn't go well, but like I'm looking forward to getting because my mates, I've got mates like the Cotswolds and stuff, and like whenever whenever he's performing near, they phone me up and they're like, he's performing, we're gonna go, and like that. So far, I haven't been able to go to one of those
and
tour
you've been
shows.
Been watching
but
him for a long
soon.
Time, and you don't see any progression at all.
There's no, I really haven't seen any improvement. I think he might have been funnier before when he did one-liners,
right?
And now he does. It's more introspective, introspective.
So it's one
stuff.
Of those things like we're talking about, like where you know stuff about him, but it's still not funny.
Yeah. Because
I think a lot of great things about the Edinburgh runs or the longer sets, like the ones we may have just done in Australia, the longer sets is you get to know the comic and
yeah.
And along the way, they might tell a couple of jokes that might fail, which is fine because you should have that freedom of failing. That's in comedy. I can't think of any other business where it's good actually to fail because you get better from it. But then you can get them back because you've got an hour.
Yeah.
And even in failing, you may not laugh at a joke or you might find it offensive. But again, you know a little bit more.
Yeah.
But with this guy, knowing more doesn't help, I guess.
No, and I mean, when I say he's bad, he's not like some comedians, in fact, a lot of comedians at the open mic level are so catastrophically bad, it's unpleasant to watch.
Uh-huh.
Whereas this guy, he's got enough of the sort of chops to sort of do it, and, you know, people will sit there for an hour, they won't walk out, but it's still got this incredible, like, badness.
That feeling at the end for him must be like his pet has died or something every time.
Yeah.
Like he's put all this investment into it and then nothing.
Well, no, I mean, there's so many comedians that just don't have that self-awareness. I mean, there's thousands on the open mic circuit who just don't have that self-awareness and they come off stage after totally tanking and just think that they smashed it.
Do you admire that? I do. There's something about that I think it's like
something.
A brain surgeon. Like,
yeah.
You know how you think brain surgeons like, how can you cut someone's head open and think that you can just do that? And they do.
Yeah,
they don't have any doubt. They're like yoga teachers or serial killers. Like they think that they're the best at what they do and they hate themselves for doing it, but they wouldn't admit that. They leave the stage like, look what I've done. Look how great I am.
And
I never had that.
I think if you've got a modicum of talent with that attitude, you can go
really
so
far.
If you're a real sociopath, then, you know, in respect to like, you know, how you believe in yourself and how you see other people, it can take you so far. I've never had that myself. Like, I think a lot of comedians who are actually, like you say yourself, you know, when you had the guy fired you in Sheffield, you believed that you're bad at comedy.
For about 3 days, I thought I was
complete.
Yeah, I believed him. I mean, I told him to apologize because he was going to pay for it. But I meant that I was going to harness some support online and make sure he knew how wrong he was.
Yeah.
But sometimes with people, they don't think their behavior is bad.
Yeah.
What were you before you became a comedian? What did you do before that for a living?
I was a criminal intelligence analyst, and then I was a consultant in national security and policing and government. Like my last sort of big job was working for the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, doing all their sort of like they got like tech stuff for delivering diplomatic telegrams across between countries and stuff. So
you know what a sociopath looks like in data. You do, don't you? And so why did you choose a live audience and live performance to express yourself?
I really enjoy it. Like for work, I mean, I think a lot of people are like this. You sort of think, well, I've got to get a good job. I've got to try and make some money and do something that's not boring. Working for the police and working as a consultant, it was project based. It was fun. It was interesting work, but it was still boring. And it was still really hard work. And going into an office, like, giving up all that time. It's so much time. Spending hours every day. Yeah. Just like, it's horrible. Like, you give up your whole life.
You know your coworkers better than you know your partners half the time.
100%, yeah. And it didn't suit me. I was unhappy. And then like doing comedy, I really found it. I found it a release. I found it really cathartic to get on stage.
Yeah.
And I'm quite a sort of I'm quite high pitched, I guess, when I do comedy. Like there's a lot of energy comes
and
out.
And you're
of me.
Quite tall.
I like that.
You're taller than me, which I love because no one is. And I don't feel like a giant when I'm around you. It's so great. But when you're on stage, you're quite a commanding, domineering presence anyway.
Right.
And I want to play something around that, another clip of yours.
Yeah.
Because I always think it's interesting because when I watch you, I think it's great that you don't try to downplay how domineering you are on
stage. Oh, that self-deprecating thing that comedians do, I can't stand that. When they come out and they're all like, oh, I'm not very good in social situations. Oh, feel sort of like me, please. It's like, oh, man, who was it? Like, not Joel Dommett or some guy. Some guy like, you know, sort of like Joel Dommett, just good looking, you know, TV presenter.
Gorgeous.
Beautiful
girlfriend, fiancé.
Like, comes out, it wasn't Joel Dommett, it was somebody like that. It came out and he's like, I'm not very good at talking to girls. And it's like, yes, you fucking are. Jesus Christ, you're like a model. You know what I mean?
I've seen other comics do that where they're like stars on TV and shit. It's like, you don't have to talk to the girls. They'll talk to you. You're famous and beautiful.
Yeah.
So let's play this one clip.
I get it that men are horrific, you know, sexual harassing animals and, you know, have been harassing women and needs to change and stuff. But some of this stuff, like somebody accused Dustin Hoffman, said he asked her for a blowjob like 20 years ago, which, you know, that's terrible. You know, made her feel uncomfortable. And it's bad she felt uncomfortable, but that's how we get blowjobs. You've got to be proactive about it. Out there and start asking some of the tough questions. Don't just sit at home on your couch waiting for a face to fall on your dick.
I was watching that, and that clip is from a club in central London, Comedy. The night is called Comedy Unleashed, and it's at the a fabulous club called The Backyard. But the purpose, Andrew Doyle we had on last week, who kind of tried to establish that night. And the night's very successful.
Yeah.
The room is packed every month when it's there. And it's a very mixed audience, isn't it? Mixed politically, mixed gender, mixed ages. Why do you think that night is so successful?
I think because the idea, the ethos of the night is comedians won't self-censor. So that's an attractive prospect. It's a selling point. And also it's backed by Spiked, so the online magazine for sort of free speech and alternative thinking and alternative ways of looking at the world. So I don't know if they promote it to their readers. The whole ethos is like, you know, having free speech and having people saying things that they might not feel comfortable saying at another club in case they offend someone.
But do you self-edit? when you play other
yeah.
clubs?
Yeah, 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 definitely.
Would you do that blowjob joke in the mainstream? Like, I saw outside the comedy store last night.
Yeah.
I walked by, we said hello. You seemed a bit tense. I don't know why, but you did seem tense. But but you were talking to people. I didn't know who they were, and I thought maybe they were professional people, and I felt like I got in the way. I don't know what happened. But anyway, maybe you can tell us later. But at the comedy store, will you do the same set that you would do at Comedy Unleashed?
I felt more comfortable. I mean, the thing is with the comedy store, that's only my second ever weekend, a full weekend I've done there.
Tell us something about the comedy store in London. Tell us.
So it's great. It's such a nice, it's just like a perfect sort of custom built club. And
it's quite large.
It's still it's large, maybe is it 400 seats?
I think it's 400 seats, yeah.
And it's like the gold standard in live comedy clubs. Mm. And it's a total joy to play. Mm. Like, you know, it's just so much, you can really rip it there, and the light and the sound and everything is just perfect. Mm. But I mean, like, you really want to play it. And you really want to get rebooked, so I do play it slightly safe there. Whereas at Top Secret, I'd maybe do the blowjob joke. Mm-hmm. In fact, yeah, I did. I was emceeing Top Secret last week, I think it was, and mm-hmm. I did the Me Too blowjob joke.
You feel something. A bit freer there.
Yeah, like I know that Mark believes in me, and he's gonna like
Mark, who runs Top Secret.
Who runs Top Secret? He's gonna book me again. Well, fingers crossed. And I'm here quite a lot. I was here like the last two nights after the comedy store as well. So I'm here quite a lot, and so I feel more comfortable. I feel like I've got room to mess around a little bit more, and, you know, do stuff that I maybe wouldn't do.
I mean, that's the thing. You're a commanding presence on stage. You have a very, you know, a billowing voice, and you're very you seem powerful. Anyway, and when you say hitting down or punching up, describe what that means to
well, this is interesting, because people say that comedy shouldn't punch down, so you shouldn't do jokes about, you know, at the expense of, you know, any minority, or, you know,
if you're not a minority.
Yeah, unless you are that minority or another minority that's intersectionally judged to be, you know, have more points or whatever. It's very complicated.
Yeah, just kidding. Yeah,
but you know, I sort of understand that, but I mean, I open my show, you know, making fun of disabled people for being able to park close to the door in Tesco and stuff. You know, I think if you can get people, I think if people laugh at that, it's fine. It's not really punching down. And also, I think the whole idea of punching down, because being a victim these days, being some sort of marginalized minority, being a victim, gives you such power. You know, like the Me Too women are ending careers, they're making millions of dollars from their books and their tours and stuff. Being a professional victim. Look at Jussie Smollett, the Empire actor who faked his own racist homophobic attack against himself.
Yeah,
and it just showed why actors need writers. So he was like, man, like it was like they had a noose and MAGA hats, and they, like, you know, shouted like KKK stuff, and it's like, he's got a noose. Where'd they get the noose?
I know.
He's got a noose in 2019. It's like, were you also burgled by somebody who carried a bag with swag written on the side?
There was no nuance to that attack at all. Seriously, you're
it's
right.
Like,
I know.
Scooby Doo baddie.
I know. People actually, a couple of people said, you know, I think he borrowed that from a previous episode. that wasn't his. Plagiarized that racist attack. But so when you're thinking about writing material, you're not thinking, am I punching below or punching above? You're just thinking, what makes me laugh? What do I find funny?
Yeah.
In fact, sometimes people see me and I think they think that I write things with the intent of offending, but I never do.
Yeah.
I'm like you. I write what I think is funny. Sometimes I'll write something about race or gender or societal, you know, norms. And I think that this has been done. What my worry is that it's hack.
Right, yeah.
And then I do it on stage and people act like it's never been talked about before. I'm like, well, why not? Why hasn't this cover? What have people been talking about for the last 5 years?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always, just, again, a surprise to me that in a live performance in a comedy show, people are shocked that you might bring something up that they don't know about.
Yeah, yeah. And also, like, I mean, a comedy club is almost like a jury. So if you're really mean, if you say something mean that's really sort of nasty about, you know, a group of section of society or whatever, then people won't laugh because it's nasty. And people won't find that funny. They won't find it likable. So, you know, I think if you're doing something and people are laughing, it can't be that bad. It's like, that's why we have a jury of 12 men and women.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's because that works. They can judge their peers.
It is funny. Like when Joe Brand made that remark on the radio recently, got in trouble for it, where she made a remark about throwing, I think she talked about throwing battery acid on politicians.
That's right, yeah. And, instead of milkshakes.
Right, instead of milkshakes. And I, which has become a trend here in the UK. And then I read online and in the press, people criticizing her saying it was not a funny joke. Mm. But if you listen to the recording, the audience laughs really loud at it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're right, that is the telltale.
Yeah.
Did the audience laugh or not?
And I think with the Joe Brand thing, like when you decontextualize that joke and take it out of the show and like just have it printed on paper, it doesn't seem like a funny joke. But Joe Brand's character is a very character-driven joke. You know, her character is very sort of scathing and very sort of, you know, will say things like... Right, like that same
and very self-deprecating things. As well.
Self-deprecating, which makes her able to say stuff like that.
But you can say that about a lot of comics material if you see it on paper. It's more about the way they deliver it, right?
I mean,
you have to be in the room with them while it's happening.
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, is that sort of because how long have you been on the circuit? How long have you been performing on the circuit?
I started 10 years ago, but I was open mic for ages.
Why?
I was just terrible. And then I started doing puns, and I got good at
puns. I like the puns you do, though. I like the eyebrows, the big bushy eyebrows and the puns.
Yeah, I used to do this character.
You did an entire run at the Fringe.
Did two runs. And people genuinely loved it, but it was a really hard show to do, and it was sort of painting myself into the corner. It was improvised puns. I dressed up in spandex with fake eyebrows and stuff, called myself Pun Man, said I was here to save humanity from observational comedy and long-form anecdote-based humor. And then I got people to shout stuff out, and I did puns based on what they shouted out. So it was always like, you know, pinging off the crowd, and it was a fun show to do, and people loved it, but oh God, it was like, I mean, I didn't feel like Bill Burr doing it, you know what I mean? There's no artistic credibility.
There's no arc, there's no narrative, right? You just have to kind of, and then some nights did you get people that just weren't giving good suggestions or didn't understand the theme?
Dying as pun man, dying while you're dressed
in your
spandex.
Own show.
Yeah.
What was your favorite pun you
and,
came
like,
out of
you
it
You never
with?
Get offered blowjobs after the show.
No,
you're
no the pun man.
Pun man
yeah, not in that outfit. But did you come out with any puns that you still use in your act? Because puns are big in the UK. Yeah. People love them, they do.
Yeah,
right?
People do love them. I don't really do any puns in my show because I think they're terrible. And also it's a gear change.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's a real sort of gear change if you start doing something like that.
And it's hard to say that puns are very specific. It's hard to tell there's between a play on word and a pun. Although, is that the same
it's
thing?
The same
or something
thing.
That's ironic and a pun? Because irony and pun can be the same or different.
Right. A pun is like a word with a double meaning, like a pleonasm.
Right. But if you turn a word, that's not necessarily a pun, is it?
So irony is more...
Like if I say in my act... Are there any radical Muslim fundamentalists in the room?
Yeah.
Because they're usually they're dying for attention. Now
that's
not
a pun.
Is that a pun?
That's a
or turn on a word.
I'm not sure. It's kind
weird,
of a pun.
Right?
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
I mean, a pun.
What's your favorite pun? Do you have a favorite one?
Well, fun I used to do. I said I've got nothing against Islamic fundamentalists. I just don't like it when they Ramadan my throat. I did a few about ISIS.
So and the thing about ISIS is, it's like when you do, like, you know, I had to write handicapable cripple jokes because in the Edinburgh Fringe, it used to be, in the first week, the locals would come because the tickets are cheaper. I think it might still be true. And the first couple of nights, every time I'm up there, I get a couple of rows of crips in their chairs, or what we call crumblies in Scotland, right? Crumblies, you call them crumblies, because they crumble off their chairs. They call them crumblies. Anyway, you may not know that because you haven't been in Scotland for a while. But anyway, so I just wrote about 5 minutes on people in wheelchairs.
Yeah, yeah.
Because for one thing, by the way, they ruin the row behind them because their chairs are so high, they're so you lose all those chairs, right? It costs you twice as much to have them. And so I would write all this oftentimes sexualized material about them because people assume that they don't get horny or that they're not real people.
Yeah, this is the thing. If you're doing the joke, people love it when you do jokes.
They
about them
do. The people
they feel
in
included.
Wheelchairs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like, but then like some well-meaning, like able-bodied...
will defend them.
Yeah,
when they
yeah.
don't want their defense.
Yeah, wave a flag for them. And it's like, dude, they can look after themselves.
Exactly.
You know?
And if they can't, fuck them. But tough break. But that was always the problem with LGBT audiences is I would make a joke about, say, a woman in the front row and a straight woman, by the way. And the room would think they had to defend her.
Yeah.
And she's like, and I would get emails from that very same person saying later, I didn't need anyone to defend me. Thanks for the show. But that's the thing about well-meaning middle-class white people, isn't it?
Yeah.
They always think that, you know, they their sensibilities are being tortured by you.
Yeah, yeah. And also they feel that they have some, you know, super power. They're enhanced people over everybody else. It's very arrogant and very racist.
A little bit, yeah. Presumptuous,
like they've got their own superiority embedded into them. And
like they know better than that person you're making fun
of.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And they're the only person who can come in and save the day. You know, this person can't possibly look after themselves because they're whatever minority.
And they're laughing at the joke you're telling because they hate themselves.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And does that make you want to write more? See, the thing is, in 2001, I think I went to Edinburgh and I'd written a musical about a rehab clinic. Anyway, we were rehearsing it in San Francisco. I had a cast of characters and stuff. I wasn't in it. Well, I was, but I wasn't the lead. And we lost our funding. But I had this big room I had to fill. Yeah. The Pleasants wouldn't let me out of the contract. And I didn't want them to, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So they said, you have to do a stand-up set, but I hadn't written a new show. So I quickly cobbled a show together. I was writing some of it the day of my first preview there.
Right, yeah.
I made them wheel in a mannequin. I dressed it up as because Diana just died a couple years before.
Yeah.
So I slowly dressed it up as Wills in school in a school uniform. And at the end, I got down on my knees and blew them. All this hack stuff, right? And I had a cunt count board, people walking out. I would, you know, one, another one walked out, another one. The show was just, I mean, really.
But that's the one that, is that the one that won you the award?
It didn't, no, oh. No. It actually got me banned from Australia. But anyway, it did well, though. It did well. It did well. And part of the reason why it did well was, you know, people just took such offense to it. But people that didn't take offense promoted it for that reason.
Yeah, yeah.
And I did this. I wrote, that's what I'm talking about. I did these jokes. I'd just been in Amsterdam playing Toomlers, and the guy saw me doing Anne Frank material and got really angry about it, the guy who ran the club. And he criticized me, and I said, you can fire me and send me home or let me do my material.
Yeah.
So arrogant. Anyway, the bar guy, who's a bit closeted, really hot, said, look, I will tell you how to tell that joke. And he taught me how to buffer the joke, and it worked.
Right.
Anyway, I brought this Anne Frank stuff to that show, thinking that, oh, surely in the Edinburgh Fringe, people have been fan of Anne Frank before. It's been a while.
Yeah.
And I did this material, and the people just lost their shit over
it. God.
I mean, people stormed out. And a couple of papers that are there that reviewed me for being brave and all this shit. But all I thought was, clearly, I've got to write more material about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Seriously, no one's writing about it. So that's how, I don't mean to, you know, I'm inspired by people's reactions.
Yeah, yeah.
Because to me, that means it's working.
Yeah, yeah. And a negative reaction, as long as you know that, you know, you're not getting a mass negative reaction.
Right.
Like when I did a preview for my new show at Top Secret on this stage right here, there's a woman, a drunk woman in the audience who started heckling. She thought, I think she was just sort of, because she was drunk, she wasn't really following the show and what I was saying. And she started heckling. And then everybody in the audience was telling her to shut up and fuck off. And then she started crying because everybody was like, but it was amazing, the electricity in the room.
Great.
When you get something like that, it makes it so exciting. And you know, when you go and see a show, if stuff like that happens, it makes the show, you know, it's like you're not just watching a performance. It's this live like thing. Everybody in the room's involved and everybody's like switched on to what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And people are taking sides and stuff. But when you're up there, because you're 6'5" and because you're smart and commanding, you're probably the smartest person in the room anyway, and you know that about yourself. I mean, part of you must know that that's why you're there, or else you wouldn't be on the stage. Because part of you, you know, I think a lot of comics, big ego, low self-esteem. I mean, you know there's a part of you that knows that you're running this room, that you're sailing this ship, that you're the captain.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like when you're up there in a situation like that, like maybe you have too much power? Is there a way for you to sort of relinquish it and balance the room a bit? Or are you concerned with any of that? Do you just take your power and run?
I've never felt that. I mean, I've never felt like I'm imposing on people, if you know what I mean, and making them... Actually, that's a lie. Sometimes I can tell I'm forcing people to sit through something they're not enjoying.
Like you kidnapped
when you're
them.
Doing previews. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can just tell people have rocked up for, you know, they just want to see some comedy.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're talking about transgender issues and your own sexual assault and all this sort of stuff. As a victim, not a perpetrator. Right, I should probably add that in.
Yes, yeah. You better quickly add that in. And yeah, and you think they're just sitting here because they have nowhere else to go. And they're afraid if they get up that you'll kill them.
Yeah, they saw some comedy on TV in the 90s and, you know...
But fair enough. I mean, you know, I think everyone likes something different, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. There's shows. I mean, as well as the Comedy Unleashed shows, there's a lot of shows where they've gone the other way and they've put explicit limitations on what people can talk about.
Where?
So there's Quantum Leopard, which is run by a guy called James Ross, so you're not allowed to do any jokes, you know, at the expense of anybody, no sexual assault material or anything like that. Even if it's you're not, and they put green dots in the forehead of people in the audience that you're not allowed to speak to.
They do what?
They put green dots on people, and then you're not allowed to speak to them when you're on stage because there are people who have anxiety. I'm not even.
Why are they in the club?
I guess it's to be inclusive so that everybody can come, even people who suffer from social anxiety can come to a club and have a green dot in their forehead.
So is this what you mean when you said earlier that free speech needs to be supported in comedy clubs, because not all... Do you think that there is a challenge?
Well, the thing is, man, I just think these guys are so hypocritical. There's another guy called Chris Coltrane, who James Ross booked for his Quantum Leopard Club to headline all the time. Chris Coltrane also ran a night as Lolitics Night, and you were the
Lolitics.
Same... Lolitics. Sort of, I think it was called Lolitics, and you weren't allowed to do, you know, all this, like, rape jokes, sexual assault jokes, anything like that. Turns out, he's a serial sexual assaulter of women, and he just didn't want people belittling his hobby. He's like, he got outed on Twitter. It was amazing. One of his victims outed him on Twitter, said, you know, just tweeted saying like, you know, look, you carry on like you're this great, you know, male feminist. You sexually assaulted me at a party and all this sort of stuff.
Like a Catholic priest raping
kids. He just disappeared overnight. He disappeared. His Twitter shut down. His website shut down. He disappeared. All his bookings disappeared. So he's just gone to ground and now he's just doing a normal job.
But that's what I'm saying to you. We can't have it both ways, can we? Either you let this guy work.
Yeah.
This serial harasser person. Or none of us work, in a way I feel that way.
Well, I mean, no, I think this guy, this sexual harasser guy, he shouldn't be allowed to work. But he was the guy who's running this right-on, left-wing
No, I understand that, but thing. Shouldn't he be allowed to work, just let the audience make up their minds, whether they want to sit through that or not?
And what, you just announced before, you have a big sign outside the club being like, rapist on tonight.
I don't know. I mean, I just feel like this is coming from a perspective of someone who just could not get booked in mainstream clubs for quite a long time. Yeah. And I used to go do the Sunday night open mics and rip the fucking place. Mm. And then I'd say, why don't you book me? They'd be like, well, we don't think women are funny, so we're not going to book you. And this went on, that went on for a long time.
Right, yeah.
And I never know still, you know, there was all this falderal recently about Louis C.K. not getting booked in the UK, comics going online, stopping him from getting booked.
Yeah.
And my feeling was, and they were all congratulating themselves, and my feeling, including that person in Sheffield who fired me and who trolls me online still,
right.
And my feeling is, until you can provide a safe, and I know this sounds arrogant, but you can provide a safe space for LGBT or any minority comics, not necessarily on stage, because I never think it's the audiences that you have a problem with.
Yeah.
It's the promoters and producers that harass
people
and
with
harass.
Power.
Yes, exactly. And until you can provide safe places around those people, then all this kicking out Louis C.K. bullshit or the sexual harassment person, it's all bullshit.
Yeah.
They should be allowed on stage.
And it's like we know people in the industry who, you know, sexually assault people.
Yes.
And we still work with them. You know what I mean?
There's clubs that I walk into where the promoter says, Hey Scott, there's all this gay camp, hey Scott stuff for like 5 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
Until all the other comics looking down embarrassed, because in Britain people get very embarrassed easily. And I have to go, like that for quite a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is after 25 years on the circuit.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, I think until everyone's seen as being, you know, a pound sign.
Yeah.
Until you think you can extract money from everybody, not, you know what I mean? That's what it should be. It should be a Marxist concept.
And that's what you're seeing with corporate. I mean, look at all these corporations, Pepsi, everybody doing the, you know, the rainbow sign on their logos for gay pride, which is great. You know,
it is. I think it's great too.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But I also know that in Bahrain, they're not running that ad campaign.
They're not running. Yeah, and they should.
Yeah, they should.
I'm surprised they're not, because they're all about money too. Tesco has a little corner, a cardboard area where you can buy all this gay stuff. It's all rainbows, including like 10 paper plates for everything's £1.50. And I thought, the assumption being that some queer who uses paper plates with rainbows on a dinner party has 9 friends. That's ridiculous. But my husband got a bit thrown off by it. I'm like, no, this is good.
Yeah, yeah.
This is what gays actually kind of wanted all that time.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't really want this. But what we wanted in the 90s when we were doing the ACT UP shit, we wanted healthcare.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to necessarily assimilate, but we wanted an even groove next to your even groove.
Yes, yes.
And now we've got it.
Yeah, yeah.
in a way, although
there's still that sort of separateness and being sort of treated as a novelty. And also, I mean, I think Hannah Gadsby, I thought her, I didn't really like her special, but she had some really good points in it. And one of them was like, there's this huge pressure on gay people to celebrate being gay this, you know, extrovert sort of Mardi Gras carnival stuff.
It's a bit blackfacey.
Yeah, and it's like, what about, you know, people who are introverted and don't want to do that? You know, it's not everything can be rainbows and glitter and dancing in the street.
Well, in Birmingham 3 weeks ago, since you brought up, this woman rushed the green room after I closed it.
I read about this.
Yeah. And she went out to, how could you, screaming at me, and they had to restrain her. By the way, and you're not allowed in the green room, and it says clearly on the story. But this is this white middle class woman who thinks that she knows better. And you've ruined my party, my 60th birthday. My mother died last night. I almost didn't come. Well, why are you here? Anyway, and she said, because it's gay pride. And it was gay pride that weekend. And you know where the club is, right in the middle of gay pride in Birmingham. Yeah. And oh, we're so mad. And I said, the club owner said, well, he's gay. No, he's not. She thought I was a straight guy.
Doing an act.
Which is brilliant. I wish that was true. That'd be so brilliant. But that's the thing. I don't think gay people have a wild card anymore.
Right, yeah.
I don't think we have it.
Well, funnily enough, my friend Stephen was saying, because he's gay and he's a comedian, and he was saying, like, gays, it's not seen as a minority thing anymore. You're not seen as a sort of victims. You don't get that sort of, the charity.
Yeah.
You don't get that sort of charity.
No. Like, if we say something outrageous, and it's like, why are you saying that? You're one of us. Yeah. You don't get to say that shit anymore, right? And then I have to say, look, I'm a black lesbian in a wheelchair. You have to say so many things. Do you find this? So do you ever find, do you feel the need to buffer the audience as you're going along?
Yeah, I've got, in my show, I've got bits. So I've got bits about Me Too, sort of criticizing the women for, you know, because there's an angle of Me Too that's the women. They willingly sucked Harvey Weinstein's dick. So it wasn't all, you know, one-sided. They wanted to be stars. And man, he, for a lot of them, he fulfilled his side of the contract. And I'd fucking love to have that opportunity to suck his dick and become a star. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right. You wouldn't be like, talking to me right now in this crappy little room, no air conditioning. No, it's true. Yeah, you'd be.
So, I mean, there's a side, but nobody acknowledges it. It's all like, you know, Harvey Weinstein is this horrible monster and these are innocent victims and stuff. You know, which is one side of it, but, you know.
But it's you must admit, it's a terrible position for a female actress or male.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
To be put in order to get a role in a film, you've got to, you know, fuck some guy. I mean, I know it's been going on in Hollywood for 100 years and it's disgusting, right?
Oh, yeah, it's disgusting. And, you know, Harvey Weinstein's a total fucking animal. You know what I mean? Just like, and these men who abuse their power, you know, I think it's disgusting. But, you know, I think, you know, we can look at other sides of it. Yes. You know, like the asking Dustin Hoffman for a blowjob.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? That's how we get blowjobs.
And it's kind of our job to find the joke in it, to help people process it.
So I've got to buffer that by talking about my own sexual assault. But it's a funny story because I'm a man. And when bad stuff happens to men, it's funny.
Were you assaulted?
Yeah, when I was 17 by a doctor. Because I went in, like, basically I was run over when I was 17. Don't know if you've seen my leg, but I got run over by a truck.
Oh,
so,
my God.
Yeah,
He's showing me a huge, what looks like a purple... kind of a huge purple mark on his calf. And is that a skin graft?
Yeah, that's a skin graft. And like my leg was just smashed to bits and stuff. Like I woke up and my foot was on the ground. And like I went to pick my leg up and my foot stayed in the ground. It was like, it was amazing that they managed to put it
never
back
told
together.
Me all right, so
and regrow the bone. But like, so when I came out of hospital.
But you look, you walk.
Yeah, it's fine. Kind of fine now. Mostly fine. But like when I came out of hospital, so I'd been on morphine and everything. And it was a long isolating process. And I came out and my head was just screwed. And I was using a lot of drugs just to sort of, you know, stay alive kind of thing. And I ended up going to the, started university and I went to the doctor on campus and I said, look, I think we've got depression or something. You know, I can't eat, can't sleep, can't get a boner, can't talk to people. And he said, well, I just need to check.
I like how you said the boner took priority. Or
yeah, that's
anyway,
the first thing.
No, I feel the same way, but yeah. Anyway, go on.
But he said, okay, I need to check your testicles. And I didn't query it, you know what I mean? Because he's a doctor.
Of
so
course.
I lie in this gurney and he checks my testicles for age. And I was like, man, this doctor's really thorough. I've got a good doctor, you know?
And good testicles, obviously, right?
And then like 2 years later, I was talking to my mate, because I dropped out of uni. I was talking to my mate who's still at uni. And he was like, do you hear about the campus doctor? And I was like, no. And he's like, oh, he was sexually assaulting people. He said, anything you went in for, you know what I mean, a cold or whatever, he'd be like, I need to check your testicles. And I was like, no way, no way, he did my testicles. I was in there for depression. Like, oh. And my mate's like, did you not think it was strange that he was like checking your testicles?
But imagine if he hadn't, you'd feel worse, wouldn't you? No. You let no one ever check my testicles.
I'm not a doctor. I mean, the ball bone's connected to the head bone or whatever.
Well, a lot of male problems happen in the scrotum area.
Yeah, yeah. It's hormones.
Did it help when he checked your testicles? Did you feel better after?
I mean, it was an experience. You know, yeah, I mean, yeah. It sort of tickles. And man, I don't begrudge. I mean, even though I guess it's like technically violated me and sexually assaulted me for his own like sexual thrill, but I don't begrudge him it at all. You know what I mean? He can have a go if he's out of jail. He can have another go if he wants. You know, although
you're postcarding. And so what you're saying then is you if something happens to you in your life that's not great, writing a joke about it helps.
Yeah, and also if you can show that side, if you can show vulnerability on stage,
and that buffers
it buffers
when you tell other stuff.
When you call the Me Too victims whores.
I don't know if that's going to make the edit. All right, so how far along are we? 59? Okay, great. Let me just look at my question and see if we... Oh, you host tonight. Let me ask you for one. Actually, I want to ask you, do you think the comedy... Is there anything about it that's an aphrodisiac, do you think? Do you think that humor is something that appeals to people in a way that music does?
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe not as much of an aphrodisiac as music, but it definitely makes you like, women are like, oh, that's interesting, you're a comedian. You know, it's like, it gives, you know, it's something that they're attracted to. Obviously, then, when you're actually in a relationship, comedy's horrifically corrosive on relationships because you're traveling all the time. They're sick of just, you know, every weekend is comedy instead of going to their friends' birthdays or weddings or whatever.
It's like having a mistress, right?
Yeah. So it's really...
Also, I mean, you're using the comedy when you have problems.
Yeah, totally. And you're talking about them on stage and they know that, you know? Like, last year, so my ex-girlfriend, like, she cheated. She had a threesome, an MDMA-filled threesome.
Your trans girlfriend?
No, this is another girl.
You're busy.
Yeah, like amazing girl. And I mean, this is what early doors when we're getting together, but like affected. I was cheating on her as well, but like, you know, affected me a lot. And then like we had this tempestuous relationship. She ended up flying out to Australia and punching me in the face. And then we broke up. But comedy was such a... When we finally broke up for the last time, I was touring Southeast Asia, and it's just impossible to sort of have that... You know, at the end of it, she just wanted a guy who had a 9-to-5 job, because then he's going to be there in the evenings, he's going to be free at the weekends, he's going to... You know, she's not going to have that stress and that jealousy and that worry. It's really difficult. She think, you know, when you're out... When you're away, they just think that, you know, you're getting offered blowjobs and stuff, when in actual fact, you're just hanging around with bald guys in green rooms, you know, like you're not doing anything fun.
You're just trying to get your Wi-Fi to work.
Yeah.
No, it's true. You know, do you think, in a way, I think people find comedy appealing, sexy, because you're making them laugh and they think you get them, right?
Yeah.
You understand what's going on with them.
Yeah.
And then... So happens, like you just said, in a relationship, what they love about you beginning, they hate about you later on when it's not working out. Yeah,
yeah. And I think it's, you know, alluring. And also, like, I think comedians, because our lives are so, we're just hanging by a thread all the time. So, you know, we fuck like dying men, you know what I mean? Like, there's like, it's the last day on earth, so they like that. And it's like,
fuck like that.
it's not like, you know.
I know. I mean, we're so desperate for contact
that
when we finally get it, we're all over them. I've had people say to me, not in my marriage because we don't do this anymore, but people say to me, you know, do you always kiss like that? I have, because I'm pretty good at it.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, it's just about tactile contact.
Yeah, and having that empathy and that relationship with someone.
It's never enough. The stage set, it's never enough.
Yeah.
We need more all the time, more.
Yeah.
I've never, you know, I agree with you. I think that my husband thinks when I'm touring and he's not around, that, you know, in comedy clubs, people approach me. I'm 56. No one's approached me for years. But when I was younger, a little bit did. A bit. But it was always for the wrong reason. And oftentimes, it was because they were frustrated stand-ups.
Yeah.
Does that occur with you? Do women approach you because they want to do comedy?
Yeah, it happens. Like, quite often I'll match with women on dating apps, and they'll be trying to do stand-up comedy. But I can't really date anybody who's a comedian. I just think it's... Well, imagine if things go wrong and you know, then they say, oh, Leo was, you know, he likes, you know, doing this, and he's treating me like shit, and blah, 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 and he stuck his thumb up my ass. And, you know, like, that's the last thing.
All right, okay, Jesus.
Jesus Christ. All right. No, I did hear that about you. I'm glad you admitted it. So that was my next question. So
you host a night called Hate and Lies.
Yeah.
Co-host. And tell me about that show.
Yeah, so it's really fun. Basically, it's a sort of freedom of speech show. The audience writes down what they hate, and it goes into a bucket. Hmm. And then we pull it out, and the comedians have to say why they hate it. We've got a series of rounds, and comedians can take angles on it. Some people rant, you know, some people go right down the line. Other people, you know, go on surreal tangents, explaining why they hate stuff. And it's there's that real sort of tension and release, you know, when something contentious comes out of the bucket. Mm. Like I've had to hate on the abolitionist slavery. Like that's a tough one to
and
hate
what
on.
What did you say about that?
I had to hate on, I can't even remember. I remember
one person gets hate and one person gets like, right?
No, everybody gets hate, but then we get like, you know, there's different rounds where sometimes you have to love it and stuff. And if it's something that's too easy to hate, sometimes Darius, the host, he'll flip it and make somebody love it. So say it's Hitler or Donald Trump, he'll make you love Donald Trump.
Right. Has that ever gone? I've done it a couple times, and I've done it late at night at the Edinburgh Fringe when the audience is hammered. And I've always thought this could go either way. This could turn into a huge bar brawl. You could piss people off, push it so far.
Has that
ever happened? Where it's
really? Especially
what was the
with
subject?
Darius,
remember what
Darius is such a like you know antagonist.
He is.
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And so we're doing one and. In fact, yes, it's happened a few times when people, you know, think we shouldn't be like. Now we're very careful to spell out the fact that you know anything goes, and it's the audience. They give us extra leeway because they're complicit in it. They're writing down the things that go in the bucket, and obviously we filter it now to filter out the genuinely, you know, hateful stuff. Like we'll never pull out. We'll never say, "Tell us why you hate," you know. Gays or black people or whatever.
Oh, really? It's just, I like that.
Well, unless we've got a gay person, then we can tell them. Ask them. And then it's going to be funny because, you know, they're doing it. But, like, for me to hate on, I mean, you can still do it. Like, it really depends what the...
If you can make it a personal...
In a way, and also like you know you can go off on a funny tangent or do something that's actually complimentary to gay people. But I think we don't like
I hate gay people because they're all in shape or something like that.
Something like that. You know, like I don't like it. I don't like the feeling. I don't want the audience to have the feeling that there's other people in the audience who hate, you know, Jews.
Actually,
or gays
hate.
Or, actually, you know, which. So we try and like filter out the
like
more
if you said you
ones.
Got why I hate gay people and they said who put this in the box and a gay person said I did it and then you thought well then we could
which is the ideal scenario but then like you know people usually because people have been coming to the show for like 7 years so they write good suggestions in the bucket so I had like people who jumped early on 9/11 so having a hate on something like that is just
say?
It's amazing I had to say because things could have got better they could have been. They could have been sitting in helicopters.
You never know
what I mean? Like, just
right. Give up.
Just like, oh, God. I was having a bad day anyway. All this photocopying.
I was already a waiter.
Now it's on fire. Geez. Oh, I'm just going to go. You know, like.
Could have gotten better.
So, yeah.
Come on. I could have cooled down. Could have had rain. All right. So we're coming near then. Blah, 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 blah. Yes, I mentioned the comic store. You being tense. Were you with professional people last night?
I didn't know I was tense. I didn't know I'd come across as tense.
Well, I walked up and I didn't know these people you were with and they seemed nice and all that. And then I said, hey, and we were chatting and then you laughed inadvertently. You went, ha. I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to go. And I just thought that you were in the middle of like a meeting-y thing. Oftentimes people, when they're playing the store, they'll have their management come or people are trying to impress because it's a good club and it's a great room and... Was it a professional relationship?
A friend from Vancouver. I lived in Vancouver about 18 years ago now.
Right.
So I knew her in Vancouver.
But it could be because you're at work. I mean, when we're at work, we're different. I think. In between two shows. I just thought it was funny. Because I just am so used to you being very relaxed about stuff. And one other thing. Okay. So has being Scottish made you anxious or resentful?
About what?
Because you said hating the English, but you're trapped in England performing.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you around a lot of people you hate all the time?
No. I mean, I'm not one of these Scots who hates the English. Like, I experienced it in Scotland because my parents are English. Mm. And I think it's weird. In Scotland, we've got like the Scottish National Party who are just like this parochial, small-minded, you know, kind of slightly hateful, regressive party. But for some reason, everybody thinks they're wonderful. Because
they show up late at the Parliament.
They're like, you know, people think they're great. Whereas the British National Party, who are the same sort of thing, are like, you know, seen as these horrible fascists. Scottish National Party, like they're really kind of shitty, and also they're all socialists. So they're always trying to get involved in things and make it worse and spend money making it worse. They've passed these new laws that mean that Edinburgh Festival flats can't be rented out to festival goers,
yeah,
which is going to slash the audience numbers and makes it really expensive for comedians. And you know, long term could really negatively impact the Edinburgh Festival. Yeah. It could move to another city. So that's, I mean, and nobody was wanting that law. The students didn't want it. It's going to make their rent more expensive. The landlords don't want it. Obviously, the audiences and the comedians don't want it. So it's not helping anybody except some apparatchik in the Scottish National Party who's drafting this legislation. You know, I mean, it's honestly, like, yeah. I don't know if you've seen Chernobyl, but that is socialism. I've worked for left-wing councils.
Their
and
skin's going to peel off. But do you enjoy performing in Scotland when you go out there? Do you like it?
Yeah, I like it, yeah. Although, down here, I've got an identity as a Scotsman.
Yeah.
If I perform in Glasgow, I'm just another perfume Ponce. You know? I mean, I'm not a real Scotsman.
Well, we appreciate you coming here. Thank you so much for talking about your work and letting us know what inspires you.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, good luck with everything.
Cheers, thank you.
Take care. See you next week with another great comic. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Oh, hi there. If you want to find this podcast on Twitter, you probably already have. But if you haven't, it's at Scott Cupuro, ScottCapurro. It's the same address on Facebook, where I'll hopefully be downloading this podcast, and all over social media. So take care and see you next week. Thanks. Bye.